got my bags packed and on a roll. I'm heading out there and I'm ready to go. I'm looking real good in my passport photo.
Amateur Traveler, episode 420. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about beautiful blue waters, wonderful food, and layers of history as we hike the Lycian Way in southern Turkey. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have just one news story for you. If you're looking for the ultimate luxurious experience in air travel, I think you'll have to look at Etihad Airways. Etihad is now the first airline to put multi-room suites on a plane, that is, on a commercial plane at least. They're not big suites, but they're 125 square foot, including a living room area, partitioned off the first class aisle, leather seating, chilled mini bar, a 32-inch flat screen TV, and of course, a butler. For a link to that story, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome to the show Warren and Betsy Talbot, who are authors of Married with Luggage and have come to talk to us about the Lycian Way. Betsy and Warren, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Chris.
It's great to be here.
Now, I say the Lycian Way. Can you put that on a map for us?
Sure. We're on the southern coast of Turkey, right on the Mediterranean Sea. It's 500 kilometers from Fethiye in the west to Antalya in the east.
Okay. And when I say the Lycian Way, we are talking about a place that I can go out hiking, but not just for an afternoon.
Well, you can just go for an afternoon. There are some day-long hikes you can take within it, but we took 30 days to hike.
There are some beautiful locations along there that you would stop and just do a day or two. But if you want to do the whole thing, it is definitely, you got to strap on the boots for a while.
Okay. And as we go through this, I do want, if you can, pull out maybe if the best week in there, if there are people who have a little less time. But let's talk about this trip. Why did you do it, first of all?
We love to walk. We truly enjoy it. But it all started with, I think she's probably been on your show, Sherry Ott. She put out a thing on Facebook and actually called us out by name. She had identified this as a hike that she had heard about while she was doing the Camino. And she said, I know that Warren and Betsy Talbot will do this with me. And so we were shamed into doing it.
And we did. We put it on our calendar right then. I actually think she didn't think we'd follow through. So the joke's on her.
But it turned out that we just love to hike so much. And she knew that we would be all over a long-term hike that spanned many weeks. And that was the whole goal for us. And we wanted something that was pretty remote, that very few people do, and that would allow us to just camp and enjoy ourselves underneath the stars, overlooking beautiful scenery every day. And it just turned out to be the perfect match for us.
Part of our goal in doing this was also to sort of step back from technology and from our life. We all get so busy with this kind of stuff that for us, being able to be out in nature for an extended period of time is a way to sort of not only exercise our bodies, but kind of reset our brains a little bit too. And this was perfect for that.
Okay, you say that, and I think of being away for Wi-Fi, and I just get the cold shivers, so I'm not sure that we're in the same place there.
We don't even own a phone, so we're away from a lot of technology a lot of the time anyways.
Well, I have to tell you, Chris, we actually did a pre-hike to get ready for this because I wasn't sure. I'm like you. I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to get away. So we did a seven-day hike the West Highland Way before just to prep for this. And people think we did it to exercise and see if we could do it, but we actually just did it to test our willingness to be away from technology.
And the West Highland Way is in Scotland?
Yes.
Yeah, it's on the west coast of Scotland. It was a good primer for this.
And Sherry actually did introduce us or put us together because she and I were talking about episodes that we could do because I wanted to have her back on the show and did just recently, talking about Nova Scotia, as the listeners know. But she had recommended you. She had said you had spent more time there. So why should someone go to the Lycian Way? So what are people going to see when they see this? This is a little different geographically, for instance, than the Camino de Santiago in northern Spain.
Yeah, you're going to see, this is history. I mean, you're going to see thousands of years of history, and you basically have, they trace it, you know, you can go back 5,000 years and see ruins basically from there. You've got a variety of cultures, the Lycian culture itself, which is where the whole concept of the Lycian Way, but there's so many Roman ruins that really are truly impressive.
There are actually points where you stumble across old tombs laying on the side of the trail. I mean, really, you are walking through places that should, I think, be cordoned off and protected, but they've been there for so long. So you have that combined with piney forests and sheer dropping cliffs, gorgeous Mediterranean. I mean, all of that together. And it is quite different from the Camino in that it's remote. So I know that Sherry told us that in the Camino, she's walking from village to village. And here,
there were days where we would walk 3-4 days in a row where we wouldn't see another person on the trail. And so you are off by yourself, and it gives you a chance to contemplate. And as writers, it gave us a chance to do a lot of brainstorming, a lot of alone time, a lot of conversations and inspiration. So if you're any type of creative and you get creative energy from outdoors, then this is going to be the perfect place for you, because every day you're going to find a vista overlooking the sea, overlooking the mountains, and you're just going to be by yourself, immersed in history to bring it all together.
But if you're looking for a B&B every night or a restaurant, things like that, you're not going to find that here.
Not a chance.
Well, thanks for coming on the show, Warren and Betsy. It's so nice to have you. This was my picture here of the trail going, at least for part of the time, along that coast there. And I pictured a lot of cliffs, and I know some of the tombs that you talk about are also cliffside. And we're talking about tombs that predate Caesar and predate Alexander, as I recall.
That's correct. Yeah, they've been there for 1,000 years beforehand in some cases. And so you end up with as you go, you can see the different civilizations and how they influence the land. And it's really hard to get away. Every day you're going to see another ruin. And there are days where you will sleep within them. And so there was an evening that we slept in a church that had been, it was an old Byzantine church that had been destroyed about 800 years. And we just wandered around. We spent the entire day and a night there by ourselves, sleeping in this ruin, and no one came through the entire time.
Well, goats did.
Goats did, sorry. There were goats, yeah, but that was about the extent of it. And so the experience that you have of being up close to history is different than anything I've had anywhere else in the world.
I would agree that this had a lot more than just the natural element to it. There was a lot of history, and I really enjoyed that.
Now, I'm a little surprised when you talk about it being as remote as it is, because we are, again, talking about a place that has had just layer upon layer of civilizations there. So I just pictured, again, that you were walking from village to village. I didn't realize that. Where did you start? Where is the start of the Lycian Way?
We started in a little village right outside of Fethiye called Olu Udenes, and it is the kind of place that you don't actually want to go. I mean, to me, it's like a typical package holiday kind of a place.
Yeah.
Okay. It wasn't my favorite starting point.
But it is a good place because it's relatively easy to get to. So you take a 4-hour bus out there, 4 or 6 hours.
From Istanbul?
From Antalya, so on the east. So you take a bus from there.
So you hiked east to west?
West to east.
West to east, okay.
West to east. And so you basically take the bus in and you drop off and then you start walking. And your first few days, you do go through villages. There are villages occasionally along the way. Mm-hmm. It does seem like as soon as you walk away from Olu Udenes, you're kind of by yourself for 2 weeks until you get to Cash. And then when you get to Cash, you're in a good
sized
village. A
nice little seaside resort village. Actually, yeah. I very much enjoyed Cash.
It was a beautiful, beautiful place right on the water. And so we spent a couple of days there and enjoyed the time overlooking the sea and spending time on boats. It was a nice way to spend it.
Yeah, there are a few places along the way where you can have a really nice sort of beachside experience, but it is certainly not something that's available every night.
Yeah, most evenings you'll spend, if you do go through a village, you can stay in the village, but most of the time you want to walk further. So you end up between two locations in the middle of nowhere. And in those scenarios, you need to camp. And there's a couple times you go up over mountains where you won't see civilization for a few days. And so you need to bring your own food and tent and everything.
And when you say when you stay in villages, are you staying in guest houses? Are people inviting you in? Are you staying in hotels?
Well, it's a combination of guest houses, which they call pensions, and then staying in people's homes. If you walk into the village, they'll see you walking in with your hiking backpack and your walking sticks, and people will come out and invite you into their homes. Of course, you do pay to stay in their homes with them, but there's never a shortage of finding a place in one of these little villages if you want one.
And there's never a shortage of food. The people are so incredibly friendly, and they are wonderful. And so they'll bring you into their home. They will feed you more than you could possibly imagine.
They'll send you food along the way, bread, cheese, olives, everything.
Most of the people that live along the route are farmers of some sort. And so you pass through all these different agricultural areas. So you get into the apple area and they will just load you up. Apples are not the lightest thing that you want to be carrying as a hiker, but they will give you 2 kilos of apples. And then you get into the grapefruit area and the orange area, and everyone wants to give you food. And it's just, it's fantastic. And the people really, in my opinion, are one of the real highlights of this walk.
Now, you mentioned planning for this or prepping for this by doing the hike through the West Highlands Way. Is that?
Yep. Absolutely.
And then how did you plan for it, though? How did you know? Is there one route or are there different routes?
Well, it's a combination of several small routes that have been put together. And there's a book called Hiking the Lycian. And it's by the woman who originally put all of this together back in the 80s, I think.
Yeah, the
late 80s.
Her name
is Kate Clow. Yeah. And the book is, it's helpful in the preparation because you kind of know what you're looking at. But I will say that we didn't feel like the book was adequate preparation for us once we got on the trail. I wish we would have brought a GPS. I think it would have been much more helpful.
Yeah,
to us.
But as far as preparation, there's only that book, and then you of course can read about other people that have done it. But there's so few. I mean, if you go out and do a Google search, you're only going to find a few instances of people that have walked this. And so we read and poured through all of that information and just tried to figure out, one, how fit they were, to find out, because there's one couple that did the entire thing in like 17 days. And that is insane to me. But so you kind of like figure out what it is, and then you understand what they took. And then because we had done some prep hiking before, we had a sense of what we would need. But no matter what you do, the hard thing is knowing, once you get there, where to find food and where to find water. That's probably the two elements that we really didn't have a lot of ability to prep for.
But that's one great thing about this hike, is that there are lots of water stations along the way, especially in every little village. There is some sort of mosque. And because it's a mosque, there is a water station outside.
Always.
Both for drinking water and for
the
washing
preparation.
Feet.
Yeah.
Yes,
yep.
Yes. So it actually works out very well to hike there to get water.
Interesting. You mentioned that you didn't feel that the book completely prepared you. What were the surprises? What do you think that people should know that you didn't know?
Well, the trails are not marked well, and part of that is...
That's a gross understatement. Yeah. We got lost. I mean, in 30 days of walking, we got lost every day. And there were days where we would get lost for an hour or two at a time. And that's challenging when you're carrying an extra 30 pounds on your back and you're hiking for 8-9 hours a day. It makes for opportunities to grow in your relationship.
I was going to say, since you guys do Married with Luggage and talk on your podcast and in your book a lot about relationships, was it one person's fault or the other's that you got lost so much?
Oh, no, we teamed up together.
Oh, that's
we blamed
good.
The
okay.
person who wrote the book.
Yeah,
that's much better. That's much better.
It actually became a bonding experience because it is so challenging to find the little marks. And sometimes they'll be gone. They'll have been obliterated over time. So what happens is that we just bonded really closely together in the course of that. But I do think that the book does a really poor job of explaining how you're going. It'll say, okay, walk across this field and turn left. But if you're walking across a field and that field takes you 3 hours to go across, when do you turn left? So those types of experiences are repeated throughout the book. So a GPS, while we were really resistant to the idea, I think it's critical. And that's the one piece of equipment I would take with me if we did it again.
Yeah, because I think part of the problem is it wasn't very well described. There is not a detailed map that you can take with you. The sun is very brutal there, so the markings fade because they're just done with paint. And there's also the movement of the land. If there's a landslide, if there are things like that that happen, the marks are gone.
Yep.
So it's just, I would recommend the GPS, definitely.
Yep.
Well, and it doesn't sound like this is a major effort by, for instance, the tourism board in Turkey or something like this, to if this route isn't taken that often.
Again, there are some day hikes in there. So there are certain elements. So for example, if you're hiking up to the lighthouse, there's one at the end of a peninsula. As you hike up to that lighthouse, it's extremely well marked. And the reason is that there are 2 villages on either side and they have day hikes every day there. So you'll pass a couple people.
Or any of the hikes around Cache or any of those places, they're all very well marked. So you could easily make a holiday and do part of this hike and have no problems whatsoever.
But if you want to do the whole thing, there are huge stretches for a week or two in the middle that there's nothing. I mean, and you can go for hours without seeing a mark. And so there's no one that's going in and painting those. There's no one that's gone in and hiked them from an official standpoint for some time.
Okay. And let's talk about that for just a little bit. As I think of my wife and I, for instance, who did go hiking last weekend, but we went hiking for an hour and then got pie. Is Cache the place that you would recommend for that, or?
I would recommend Cache for that. Yes. Absolutely. It's a beautiful, stunning place for one. It sits right on the water with wonderful, wonderful people. You can go paragliding. You can get on a boat. You can rent kayaks. You can rent mopeds. And then you can also go hiking. You can get right on the Lycian Way. It runs through the middle of town.
It's fantastic.
And so you could go, and there are a variety of hikes that you can do from there. One is straight up a cliff, a few hundred meters. But it is beautiful when you get up there and you walk. This is the thing about hiking and walking. If you go 10 minutes outside of where everyone else is, you're going to see something amazing and no one's going to be there. If you walk up that cliff and then go maybe walk 3 kilometers, you're going to be in the middle of an ancient Roman ruin and you'll be there by yourself. You'll be overlooking the Mediterranean Sea 300 meters above the floor and you'll be looking down on Cache. If you go the other direction, you're going to walk essentially on undisturbed beaches by yourself for hours, and you can walk for as long as you want, stop and swim, and then walk some more.
Excellent. And you say a Roman ruin. I'm picturing this as sort of the anti-Ephesus experience here, where you're standing in a Roman ruin and you're trying to get a picture past the thousands of people who are also trying to get their picture.
We never went in one where there was another person, so.
Your biggest challenge is you don't have anyone to take a picture of you. That's right. It. That is literally the only problem you have here. And there will be days, even if from Cache, where you can go into these ruins and spend hours by yourself. And if you're a history buff, oh, it's so beautiful. And that's the one thing that I would recommend to anyone. If you like history, read a little bit about this area, read about the Lycian people, read about how the Romans and why they were there. That will help you as you get on there.
Excellent. With your pack, you mentioned a GPS is one thing you would have thrown in your pack that you didn't. What were you glad you packed and what would you pack next time?
I'm glad we packed a little air mattress to sleep on.
It is very, yeah, absolutely. We had nice air foam mattresses from Big Agnes, and that was probably one of our greatest assets. Our shoes were fantastic because about 95% of the walk is on rock of some sort. And so having great shoes is really critical. And then I think the other thing is being able to make sure that we had enough water. So we had really large water bottles. While it added to the weight, there are two or three stretches where you go about 48, 56 hours where you can't find water sources. And I think those were the things that we liked the most.
Yeah, I didn't have to worry. I never felt that we were going to run out of water, and I was really glad about that. And I would also say a headlamp. We have little headlamps, and when it gets dark and you're in the middle of nowhere, it's dark.
Now, Betsy, any particularly additional issues with hiking, your normal hiking gear, and what is socially acceptable in an Islamic country? And granted, Turkey is a more secular country of some of the countries that are Islamic, but still, you're out in the countryside. Are you wearing your usual hiking gear?
Well, I am, but I have to say that my usual hiking gear is pretty conservative. I burn really easily, so I typically do wear a loose long sleeve shirt and pants. And because of the scrub in a lot of the area on this hike, you'll want to cover up. But I went to Morocco after this hike, and so there is a vast difference between Turkey and Morocco in the way that you can be. But I would still suggest being conservative in your dress in Turkey, even though it's not nearly as restrictive as Morocco. There were some instances where if I wore a sleeveless shirt that there was some inappropriate attention. But for the most part, I would say that it was fine.
Yeah, sleeveless shirt, even in Turkey, I don't know that I would recommend. But on the other hand, we had a Turkish exchange student who lived just east of there in Gaziantep. And when I visited, his mother didn't wear a hijab or anything like that. It's quite common in Turkey that you would not, although some do.
Yeah, we didn't really see any of that. Even when we were in Istanbul, we didn't see a ton of that, which is strange.
I saw that in Istanbul in the Asian portion of the city, much more so than in the European portion of the city. The city obviously being divided along the water there, the Bosphorus. But for some reason, it seemed like the people who had settled in the Asian portion were probably more recent immigrants, was my guess. But I saw it more conservative in that portion of the city, and certainly not in the European portion.
Yeah. And it's the same, even less so in the out in the country. And so everyone is absolutely, most of them are religious. And so you do have the calls to prayer are constant, almost incessant. As remote as this is, there were only two or three days where we didn't hear the call to prayer.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Hmm. Yeah. One of the things that's interesting culturally is my understanding is that in Turkey, where it is a portion of the constitution that there has to be a separation of church and state, where they literally have given the army the power to depose the state if it gets too religious, that country is more religious, for instance, than in Iran right now, in terms of on a daily basis, what the people do, even though they're imposing that you must be Islamic. So there's something about when you tell me I have to be, maybe I don't want to be, but if you give me the freedom to, then I'm interested. So,
well, Chris, it was really interesting. We were in Cache taking a couple of days off in the middle of the hike, and it was during their Republic Day celebration, which is basically our 4th of July. Mm-hmm. And they start the celebration in the evening, and there's fireworks and music and officials who speak about the great country and all of that. Well, the call to prayer started, and then the fireworks, all this stuff started at the same time to override it. And I thought, how strange that both of these are going on at the same time. We're sitting here watching this secular celebration at the same time as the call to prayer is fighting for attention over the airwaves. It was really interesting to see.
Interesting. Lots of posters of Ataturk, I suppose.
Yes.
Lots of posters. Everybody has their own Ataturk statue. And it was, again, a wonderful lesson in history as we were there learning about the country and the history of the country from the people.
What was the best single day on the hike?
I would say the best single day for me was when we were at the church of the Archangel Michael, Gabriel. And we were there. We had met another walker, and he camped with us that night. And he was a very interesting German man, but he didn't speak English. We didn't speak German, so we all spoke Spanish together. And I thought, what a great night to be here with a fire going in this beautiful setting, meeting a new friend. I loved it.
And then for me, it would be the very last morning. We got up early with sunrise, as you do when you camp, packed our bags up, and walked to Faisalus, which was the next ruin next to us, which is one of the largest ruins that exist on the trail. And it's stunning and beautiful and huge and old and everything you can imagine. And we got there and we sat down in the middle of the ruins, on the ruins, and had breakfast. And we were the only people there. We didn't see another person for the hour that we stayed there. And that, to me, was just stunning, watching the sunrise up over an ancient ruin and thinking how many people had breakfast here over the thousands of years.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned, as you were talking about Cache, the boats. I think my picture of seeing this coast is probably not necessarily doing a 30-day long hike, but actually getting on one of the gullets, one of the small Turkish boats, and doing the coastal route that way. So that's more on my list, I think, although I would say that I am more interested now in the Lycian Way, having talked to you. What was the biggest surprise?
We talked about it a moment ago, which is the religious aspect. I wasn't sure what to expect. We had not been to Turkey before. We spent a month in Istanbul before and then went down. But I think that what was different for me was just the idea that I was expecting much more of the religious influence upon the culture itself, and mm-hmm. the amount of very staunch, republic-oriented, independent, secular approach to everyone in the midst of everyone being extremely religious was really a fascinating dichotomy for me. And I was shocked by it, frankly.
I think for me, the biggest shock was that we finished it, because I was nervous. I really was nervous that I wouldn't be able to keep up and I wouldn't be able to do it. And I felt really good when we finally did make it through. But I do want to just say something really quickly. You mentioned the boat. There was a segment of our trip when we actually did go sleep on a boat at night for 4 nights, I think we did. We walked during the day, and then the boat would pick us up, and we would stay on the boat and go swimming in the afternoon. And it was a great way to do this hike. And if someone wants to go there and do that for about a week, I would highly recommend that way of doing it.
Yeah, so you still walk the entire route. You just sleep in the evenings on a boat and have someone cook for you, and you get fresh.
Oh, now we're talking. Okay.
Yeah. And that leaves out of Cache, and that it was a fantastic experience.
Yes, we took Captain Osmond's boat, yep, and it was fantastic. So I would highly recommend that. We were not planning on doing that. That was a brainstorm by Sherry, and we were a little bit skeptical of how well that was going to work out, and it was fantastic.
Well, and then the other advantage for those of us who don't like carrying heavy packs is that you're basically day hiking at that point.
Yeah, you're day hiking. You're just, yep, carrying your water and some snacks, and then, of course, they cook on the boat, and they do such a great job, and it's a really easy, laid-back, wonderful, wonderful way to see it.
And the best way to, and the thing that you enjoy the most is if you've been carrying 30 pounds of weight for 2.5 weeks and then you don't, it's like you're sprinting down the road. You're just screaming with joy. You're so happy.
Now, this was your first trip to Turkey. We have actually talked about Turkey quite a lot on the Amateur Traveler, but for anybody who's started listening in the last couple of years, you probably haven't heard us talk about it because they're older episodes. Mm-hmm. So what was your overall impression from Turkey? Did you, as I did, fall in love with Turkey?
We actually looked for real estate in Turkey. That tells you how much we liked it. Now, we didn't buy anything, but we did really like it. It's a beautiful place with fantastic people. Mm-hmm. We love the food. I could easily see going back there repeatedly.
And I think that the reason that we fall in love with places, and I'm sure it's the same for most of you, for you and your listeners, which is it's the people. There, mm-hmm, are beautiful places in all over the world. But the people changed the dynamic. And what I fell in love with was the small kind of homey feel of the little villages that we would pass through and the people's willingness to step out and talk to us. We know very little, but if you walk up and just say merhaba and then say a couple words,
hello,
people are happy. Mm-hmm. And they'll talk to you and they'll spend hours regaling you with conversation and deterring you from your walk, which is delightful.
There were many, many occasions where we would stop to have a little snack and we would be sitting on a rock and think that we were in sort of a vacant area, and all of a sudden someone comes out with a big handful of grapes for us or water or apples, and it's just always a smile and a brief conversation because of course we don't speak Turkish.
Yeah, and so we fell in love with the country and the culture by far.
Well, I did try and study Turkish when we had a Turkish exchange student, but I did find the language challenging. For example, just so people know, Turkish is an agglutinated language, meaning that you put words together like boxcars, like German does. And so, for instance, if I want to say, do you speak English? That's only two words. That's the good news. And the other good news is that the first word is İngilizce, which is English. So that's relatively simple. But the second word is a whole sentence, which is, do you speak, is konuşuyor musunuz? And I always felt that if I could say that, I wouldn't need to. If I could master that maybe I would master Turkish. But it there weren't a lot of, except for modern words. Modern words, there were a lot of cognates. There were a lot of words that are common with English that were borrowed. And then semi-modern words, words from, say, the 1800s, were borrowed from French. So a driver is a chauffeur, for instance, and you mentioned a pension. So a lot of the nouns that are newer are recognizable, but the conjugation and the verbs and the older words like food and bread and things like this are ek and ekmek and things that are not at all English related. So I found it challenging of the languages I've studied.
I'm really impressed that you dove in because I agree, it's a hard one. It is challenging. And like you said, the need to kind of concatenate words together to create different versions and different sentences was really hard for us. So good on you for doing it.
Well, you know, one thing that we did and something that we do in a lot of places that we go is to carry sort of a cheat sheet, because you can't learn the language of every place that you're going to visit, of course. But if you can have 10 or 20 phrases that you have written down that you can learn to say, first of all, it shows respect to the culture that you're going to. And second of all, it's just going to make your life a whole lot easier.
Right. Excellent. As we start to wind this down, few questions for you. You're standing in the prettiest spot on the Lycian Way. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
For me, it was early on in the hike. Maybe we were in the first week and we came down out of a very, very tough hike and it was an extremely warm day. It was probably 35 degrees Celsius and just really blazing hot.
So in the 90s in Fahrenheit. Hmm?
We get to this beach and we're standing on the beach. There's just like three or four people there in the middle of nowhere, and we strip off our clothes down to our swimsuits and leap into the Mediterranean, and we are away from our backpacks, and we both float on our backs in the Mediterranean and feels like there is nothing around us. That moment is crystallized in my memory of absolute beauty and perfection.
I think for me, a lot of times it was coming up around a bend, climbing up on a hill. You come up around a bend and all of a sudden there's the sea and there's this beautiful cliff. And I know the point for me that I thought was just so magical, and I thought we were in the most perfect spot ever. We actually got to camp there that night, and I felt really like, I mean, we've been traveling since 2010, so we've stayed in some pretty fantastic places in the world. And I told Warren, this is the best place we have ever stayed in our entire lives, and it's not costing us a dime.
About 3 or 4 hours later, it wasn't as beautiful, but
no, a great big storm moved in and we had to evacuate in the middle of the night. But when we went to bed, it was fantastic.
We should actually, I didn't ask, best time to do this of the year?
Spring and fall is best.
I would say April and November.
Yeah. Avoiding the heat of the summer.
You can't do it in the summer. It's just, it would be impossible. Imagine,
but, and then also avoiding the snow, because there are certain elements
that
along
was
the,
my next question. Okay.
Yeah. There, on the east side, when you get up over the mountains, there is going to be snow if you go earlier than April or later than November.
I think most people do it in the spring. We did it in the fall, and I'm glad we did that because we got to see the Republic Day, and we also got to see the other festival, which is completely slipping my mind right now, that happens in October. And it's 3 or 4 days, and everyone's very festive, and they invite you into their celebrations. So for me, I think that's the best time to go.
Yeah, the Feast of the Sacrifice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Excellent. And I didn't ask this one, but I'm going to get in trouble with some of the listeners if I don't. When did you feel closest to home, most familiar, and when did you feel furthest from home?
The most familiar, there's a, I think I've blocked it from my mind. You walk into the village, and it's not even a village, it's more of a holiday area. We'd been hiking about a week and a half, and the night before we'd slept in a field. We walk in, and all it is English. They don't speak anything else. Everyone is English. And we didn't, it was really challenging. There was nothing Turkish about the area. We had kebabs served by a guy that was English. And so that was when I felt the closest to home.
Yeah, it was very much a touristy kind of a place. We could have gotten anything we wanted there, I think. Yeah.
It's funny. Okay. I felt closest to home, and yet I didn't enjoy it at all, is really what you're telling me.
Yes, I think that's the best way to say it, yes. But unfortunately, it comes to mind is the visceral reaction that I had at that moment. But as far as the furthest away, would you agree that it was probably St. Gabriel?
Yeah, I would say that the ruined church that we stayed on the mountain, because we were really so far away from everything.
Yep.
Excellent. Before we get into our last three questions, what else should people know before they tackle the Lycian Way?
I would say that you need to go away for a weekend, test out all of your gear, and walk with your pack and make sure that it's okay. I'm really glad that we did the West Highland Way beforehand, because it showed me that the pack I had was not appropriate for what we needed, and I got a new one before we went.
And start early. The sun comes up around 6 there, so you can be on the start hiking by 7, and the sun's up nicely. It gets hot. The afternoons are really warm, so you want to make sure that you have invested the time early. It's where you can do it and finish at a reasonable hour. And I would also say, take your time and enjoy the scenery. Don't blaze through this. It is stunning. So you want to make sure that you are allowing yourself a little bit extra time each day to just enjoy and make sure that you are taking in the sights, because it is some of the most beautiful scenery in the history that you'll ever experience.
Excellent. Last three questions. One thing that makes you laugh and say, only in Turkey or only on the Lycian Way?
I would say listening to the call to prayer 5 times a day, every day. I mean, I think we were woken up by the call to prayer in the most remote locations.
Okay. For me, it would be the bread. Everyone just exists around bread. It just is so funny. But to me, what really shocked me was the bread is always served with the same things. So we walked for 500 kilometers and had the same breakfast for 30 days.
Okay, so it's yogurt and olives and cheese and bread.
Exactly.
And honey.
And honey.
And honey. Sorry, I forgot the honey. Yes.
Cucumbers and tomatoes.
And it doesn't matter where
tomatoes,
you are.
Right. Very fresh food too, except for the olives, which are obviously preserved, is my experience.
Oh, absolutely. And it's fantastic. But I'd never had it anywhere else, and I've never had the consistency. So to me, that would only in Turkey can I have that level of consistency.
Did you try the persimmon sauce? Did you get that? There's a purple sauce that sometimes will get served with especially with the meat and with the cucumber, onion, and tomatoes that is really good. So look for that.
Okay.
Now we have to go back.
All right, done. Yeah, Chris just talked us into it.
Excellent. Finish this sentence. You really know you're on the Lycian Way when what?
When you're walking on rocks. Okay. I kept telling Warren, I can't wait for my feet to actually touch dirt.
And for me, it would be when your story is, oh, great, another ruin, right? Because there is just, there's so many, you can't keep up with all of them. And they are, you'll run through 3, 4, 5 in a day. And so if you're walking on it, you're going to wander through ancient ruins.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize the Lycian Way in just 3 words, what 3 words would you use?
Well, for me, it would be rustic, blue. There's so, I mean, the sea, yeah, everywhere you look, this gorgeous, gorgeous turquoise blue. And then I would say peaceful.
Yeah. Okay. Historic.
Okay.
Stunning. Hard. And the last one's not to be underestimated. It is hard to walk 500 kilometers on the Lycian Way.
Despite those people who did it in like 17 days. Yeah, despite those
people. So we hate them is what you're saying.
We do.
What is the hardest part? You mentioned going up over the mountains at one point.
I think it's the perseverance. It's not any one moment in time.
It's doing it again tomorrow.
It's doing it again tomorrow. It's carrying the pack. It's having the water. It's making, no matter how sore you are, you have to keep going. And I'm making it sound like it's terrible. I do want you to know I am not a super athlete. And if I can do this, I think any reasonably fit person could.
You can. There's a couple days where you go down maybe 1,000 meters, so 3,000 feet. And then you go up 3,000 feet. And those are hard days. Just the cumulative amount of down and up that you do. So just to give you a sense, the amount of ascent that you do in the course of 500 kilometers is the equivalent of Mount Everest. So you're going up, you've got a lot of ascent in there. It's a challenging hike, but it is rewarding beyond measure.
And then how heavy were your packs?
Mine was 15 kilos, so 30 pounds.
They were about 30 pounds, yeah.
When you load them up with water.
Yeah, you have to load up with food and water every day, plus your gear, your tent, your sleeping bag, and all of that. I would say it would be hard. You wouldn't want to go much heavier than that.
Although we met a guy, the German guy. He was carrying a 35-kilo, 70-pound pack. I don't know how he did it. That was an insane amount of weight.
Yeah, he was also not a very big person. He was very slight, and I never knew how he lifted his pack. But I wouldn't recommend overdoing it on your pack because you have to carry that every step of the way.
Excellent.
Unless you get the boat, of course.
And again, that's the option that appeals to me. Warren and Betsy, where can people read more about your travels?
Well, you can always find out more about what we're doing at marriedwithluggage.com, but we did also keep a journal of our entire journey for this, and it is at hikethelycian.com. It's a day-by-day journal with pictures.
Excellent. Not with GPS maps, unfortunately.
It does not have GPS maps, sadly. I'm very sorry to say that. But it does talk a lot about us getting lost, so you can follow that along.
And we do have a link there about where you can get GPS maps. So learn from our lesson.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for coming on The Amateur Traveler and telling us a little bit about your adventures. And then, as we mentioned, Warren and Betsy also have written a book called Married with Luggage and have a podcast of the same name, if you're interested. Although that focuses more on the relationships than the travel, but you threw in some travel there as well.
We still travel, so we still see the world. So we just explain our relationship in terms of what we've learned as we travel around the world.
How we fight in love around the world. Maybe we should rename it.
There you go.
Excellent. Thanks for coming on The Amateur Traveler.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Chris. We're huge fans. We're just absolutely thrilled to be here.
I don't have much community news this week. I'm leaving for Jordan on Saturday, and you'll hear more about that trip later on. If all goes well, we will not skip a week while I'm in Jordan. I'm expecting that by the time I get back from Jordan, we'll probably have the sign-up page for the Amateur Traveler trip to Morocco in April. And again, we'll be announcing that first in the private group, amateurtraveler.com/trip, and then in the newsletter, and then on the show. With that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com. Also join the Facebook community or follow me on Twitter @Chris2X. If you listen to Amateur Traveler on iTunes or in Stitcher Smart Radio, don't forget to vote because that's how people find the show. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
I got to sit in one more. Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.